acclaimed author and Columbia University professor Jeremy Dauber has a new book, American Comics, A History, which tells the sweeping story of cartoons, comic strips, and graphic novels and their century-long hold on the American imagination. American Comics is a rich chronicle of the last 150 years of American history through the lens of its comic strips, political cartoons, superheroes, graphic novels, and much more. Jeremy Dauber is a professor of Jewish literature and American studies at Columbia University. Again, the name of the book is American Comics, A History, and we welcome Jeremy Dauber to the roundtable this morning. How are you?
Great. Thank you so much for having me here.
It's a real pleasure to have you on the program. What brought you to this idea of writing such an inclusive history?
Well, I think, you know, inclusive, I think is a great word for it. You know, it really does have all of your favorites, lots of stuff that maybe people don't know about. You know, I tried to put everything in but the kitchen sink, so to speak. And actually, there's a comic book company called Kitchen Sink Comics, so it's in there, too. I really started, like I think a lot of people do, as a comics fan. That was really where I came to this. You know, I was a kid reading the Sunday funnies, you know, out on the, you know, on the kitchen table. And then I was what they used to call a Marvel zombie. I read all of these Marvel comic books, everything they came out with. And then, you know, as I got older and became a professor, I said, you know, there's something serious in this art form that really also tells a story about American history and American culture. And I wanted to tell that story first in a classroom, and then that worked that way, and now in a book.
Give us a sense of where a good date to start is in telling this history. Where does this story begin?
That's a great way of putting it. I mean, I think that there are two great dates to think about. One would be right during the Civil War, when a guy named Thomas Nast started not just illustrating some of these battlefield sequences for Harper's Magazine, but also went on to draw comics about the war that featured figures like Santa Claus, or that served as almost, how would I put this, almost recruiting posters for the Union, you know, in their fight for the Union itself. So that's one place that really created kind of these national imagery and national images with figures like Santa Claus and Uncle Sam and things like that. And then a second date is really the grand explosion of newspaper syndicates and chains in the 1890s and 1900s, and using comic strips as a kind of circulation booster. You know, they knew that you get all sorts of new audiences, young audiences, getting their parents to buy their favorite newspapers if they had the right comic strips in them. And that really sparked the development of the comic strip as a major American art form and set us off on a path that we still see very much today everywhere in American culture.
I mean, you think you go back to like Dickens' time where they were writing serials in the newspaper and you would get each little bit each day. And that's essentially what they were doing at this time with the comics, where you had to pick up the paper to find out what happened next to these characters.
Joe, you're absolutely right. One of my favorite quotes that I found in the book was they say, you're not selling today's paper. They already have today's paper. You're selling tomorrow's paper. And that's exactly what you're saying, right? I mean, that's exactly it. They're saying, okay, you know, how do we keep them coming? Well, we want to see what happens next with Dick Tracy. We want to see what happens next with Blondie, you know, or any of these other, Terry and the Pirates, any of these other amazing strips of that period at the beginning of the century.
There are chapter headings here, which I find interesting, but it the early ones just really tell the story, which is the rise and rise of the comic strip. Comic books explode in every sense. I mean, once this genie is out of the bottle, boom, right?
I think boom is exactly the right word for it. You'd see that boom in a lot of the pages, the comic pages themselves, especially as, you know, really starting with the 30s and then going, you know, you have first these adventure comic strips, a lot of slam bang action. And then when those strips are first collected into books of comics, comic books, they start then showcasing new material, including these superheroes, Superman being the first great superhero, of course, and then so many other imitators, just as America is entering into World War II. And this really, you know, just takes off and just becomes these books some of these books sell a million copies a month at a time when the country is, you know, a lot smaller than it was, than it is now. Just an incredible hold on American culture right from the get-go of that period.
It's funny because we can certainly have a whole list of the ones that are probably still familiar with people that were in the early days, but it's not to say with this rise and boom that all were successful. There were some, many were left behind, and probably rightfully so, right?
I think that is right. You know, you have one of these characters that was the ferret. Right. That was the superhero. And his power was that he had like a pet ferret, basically. And there was one there where there was a character, a superhero. I think he had a trained bee that went out and like buzzed and stung bad guys. You know, those can be largely relegated to the amusing dustbin of history, for lack of a better phrase.
At what point did, as you look at this rise and as comic books and comic strips really start to take hold, when does some blowback begin of concerns of what is being represented in the pages of these books and strips?
Yeah, so, you know, you're right to talk about blowback. That's an essential part of the story. And, you know, it happens at lots of different stages in comics history. When comic strips first appear in those newspapers, there are people who are saying, you know, kids are having a hard time in school on Monday mornings because the lurid fantasies of the Sunday comics disturb their sleep on Sunday nights. You know, when superheroes come out in these comic books, they say, you know, all these superheroes, they are, you know, some of them even say they're fascists, right? They're not about sort of preserving law and order. They'll just, violence is the solution for everything, right? But really, maybe the most famous of these kind of moral panics about comic books really happens in the mid-1950s, when there is a senatorial hearing, a Senate subcommittee hearing, about whether or not comic books are the cause of what was considered a worrying spike in juvenile delinquency of the period. And that actually led in a way that there had been some efforts, but really this led in a big way to the regulation of the self-regulation of the comic book industry in a really fundamental way that changed the vector of comic books for decades to come.
So talk a little bit about that self-regulation, because I find this fascinating. I mean, this is just sort of the example from just about every generation. If it's not comic books, it was radio programs. If it's not radio programs, it's TV programs. If it's not TV programs, it's the internet. If it's not the internet, it's social media.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, so you really do have, as you're saying, sort of this regulation, this comics code authority that sort of had this very, very sort of extensive set of rules about what you could and could not have in comic books. And as you're pointing out, Joe, each medium, you know, like the comic book, has its own place for sort of distribution and sales. And one of the big thing in the 1950s was, you know, comic books, there were no comic book stores, right? That wasn't really a thing. What there were newsstands or grocery stores or drug stores. And, you know, you had these communities that would boycott these comics if they felt they weren't being properly regulated. And so you had, they were able to sort of display this Comics Code Authority seal of approval. And that's how you knew, you know, if you were a drugstore or a newsstand, that nobody would find this sort of offensive material in that comic. What that meant, obviously, was that these comic books were not, let's put it this way, they weren't pushing envelopes in the way that maybe the horror comics that got a lot of this moral panic sort of up in arms about, or later kinds of more mature comics that dealt with adult themes, you know, those weren't going to have that Comics Code Authority seal. And in fact, usually they weren't really produced in the first place because there wouldn't be anywhere to sell them. So that really sort of put comics as a kind of juvenile medium, certainly mainstream comics for quite a few decades.
In the chapter about censorship, from censorship to camp, you write, comics treated the decade's first great political question, civil rights, rather gingerly at first. Talk a little bit about how it was treated and how that changed over time.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we would all sort of have liked all of American culture to move more quickly on questions of civil rights than it did. And comics really was no exception. You know, and part of this was, as we're saying, for, you know, not really great economic reasons, right? They were worried, for example, that in some southern states, if you integrated a comic strip, so to speak, you had characters, black characters in them, that it would meet the same kind of fate as other attempts at integration. That is to say, there'd be a lot of backlash and opposition. And so they didn't do it sort of as quickly as they should. That began to change sort of slowly, both in the comic strips like Peanuts started to incorporate a black character. Beale Bailey did. And in comics like Marvel Comics, with the arrival of the character, the Black Panther, who then would become very, very famous in recent years in movie version. But it was sort of very kind of haphazard and sort of slow. But all of the questions about what were those characters' roles, how were they treated, how were they represented, these were questions that everybody was asking at the time, both sort of generally politically and also in sort of cultural representation.
You talk in the book, you know, we were talking about success, but when you look at, I'm thinking about comic strips and newspapers, but probably there wasn't one of the most famous of all time was Peanuts. And what was it about that strip, do you think, that really not only caught us and had us coming back, but was such a cultural phenomenon?
Well, yeah, I think that's a great way of putting it, because really, you know, the Peanuts was, I mean, it went on for many decades, right? But Peanuts really was a 50s strip. And it really comes out and really starts making its mark in the 1950s. And in certain ways, even though it was about little kids, or the characters were little kids, it really had this kind of sense of adult themes of alienation, of almost existentialism, of kind of irony and ironic comedy that really were very much of this very au courant. So you could really appreciate this strip, you know, as a 7-year-old, as an 8-year-old, and certainly I think a lot of us did as 7-year-olds and 8-year-olds, and you could really come to it as an adult and say, you know, there's philosophy here, there's theology here. Charles Schulz was a Sunday school teacher. He certainly had a lot of these kind of questions that in one way or another resonated within the strips themselves. So it really is a strip that is a work of genius on multiple levels. And I think that people were really able to attach themselves to that right away. Yeah.
Jeremy Dauber is our guest. The name of the new book is American Comics, A History. It is published by Norton. Should also mention it's a beautiful-looking volume as well. This is such a story, and we've been talking about cartoons, we've been talking about comic strips. Graphic novels come into this story. At about what point, and why do they have such an impact, do you think?
Well, you know, there's a lot of questions about exactly what a graphic novel is, but for now, let's just call it kind of a book of comics that sometimes can discuss larger and sort of more ambitious aesthetic themes, right? And some of that had to do with simply there needed to be places that were willing to house them, to sell them, right? You weren't going to sell a graphic novel on a newsstand or really in a drugstore, right? But first, on one end, you had comic stores that were developing, that were able to say, we have an audience that sort of knows what they want. They're a more mature audience. They have a little bit more money to spend. They can, you know, put down $10, $15 for a book of comics, right? And then also bookstores are beginning to say, sort of, we're talking now about the mid-'80s, the late-'80s,
right?
Really is when it starts. You know, we are seeing that some of these comics are dealing with more mature and adult themes, whether it's something like The Dark Knight Returns or Watchmen or Mouse. You know, these are comics that really could go on our bookshelves, our bookstore bookshelves, and people will buy them who wouldn't necessarily set foot in a comic shop, who haven't bought comics off a newsstand, even if they can find them, you know, in many years. So that's where it begins. And it you know, just blossoms and expands and explodes from there in all sorts of different directions. When I was growing up, you know, you could go into a public library and you could say, you know, could I have a book of comics, please? And maybe there would be one or two. Now my kids can go into a public library, you know, and they're everywhere. There are whole sections devoted to them.
Yeah, I was working in an independent bookstore when I was going to college in the mid to late 80s, and books like Art Spiegelman's Mouse and Harvey Pekar's American Splendor were coming out and coming onto the shelves. We didn't know what the hell to do with them. We didn't know what section to put them in and where people could find them, although people did find them and they wanted them. And it was really interesting because you didn't quite know what to make of them yet, and yet they made their mark.
I talk about this, and look, you're 100% right. That shelving question, you know, you're the expert, right? You did it. Was such a big question. You know, do you put them in the, you know, with comedy? Well, you know, it's hard to describe something like Harvey Pekar as comedy in the way of funny books, in the way, although there's some comedy to it, right? Do you put the superhero comics in the same section as some of these, as Mouse? It seems weird, right? That was a question that everybody, like you, were trying to figure out. And you know, to a certain extent still are, but we've come a little bit of a way from there, obviously.
Let's talk about the companies and some of the biggies of what impact film had, what impact the movies have had on comics, and where we are right now with all of that, because it seems as though at some point that the last drop has to come out of the coffee pot at some point, and yet it keeps coming.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, you know, we have many decades of even with the sort of the big characters, right? The big DC and Marvel. You know, we have many decades of story that have been, you know, intellectual property, so to speak, that has sort of been backlogged to kind of come out. And also, there are, you know, hundreds and hundreds of amazing other kinds of stories, series. I talk about many of them in the book, that will be the next great sort of adaptation, if that's one way of putting it. I think one of the symbols, you know, of the way in which this industry has changed vis-a-vis some of those other entertainment media is that for most of the story that I tell in the book, comics is largely speaking a New York-based institution, right? That's really where DC is housed in New York. Marvel is housed in New York. If you want to get jobs working at those places, you really have to live right near New York. Alternative and independent comics, those are a little different. There's a countercultural thing in San Francisco, but and other kinds of places. But really, New York is the center. Now, you know, a lot of these offices, of course, are out in California. They're out in Los Angeles, right? They're part of larger, entertainment megaliths. And there's a lot more sort of cross-brand and cross-platform synergy than ever was. And as a result, there's so much sort of close interchange between these comic books as being seen as almost storyboards for potential future movie franchises, and vice versa. You know, if Guardians of the Galaxy takes off, you say, okay, well, maybe we should do some more comic books about Guardians of the Galaxy. That's much more tightly knit than it ever used to be. And, it's a lot more California-based than it ever used to be.
You bring this up several times in the book, and I made a note because I wanted to ask you about it. But Mad Magazine plays a large role in this book, and obviously a large role in the comic scene. And it is a comic itself by nature, but it is also making fun of itself, right?
100%. Yeah, I mean, Mad Magazine, most of us, to the extent that we grew up with Mad, think of it as a magazine. But it really started life out as a comic book. It started as one of the as a humor comic published by this company, EC Comics, that did a lot of those horror comics that we were sort of glancingly referring to earlier. It then becomes a magazine and sort of flourishes after that company was sort of the top target of those sort of senatorial inquisitions and sort of hearings. And it goes on to become kind of the central address for the development of, let's say, American comedy and counterculture and sort of anti-authoritarian sentiment for the next sort of 15, 20 years. If anybody who is doing comics of these sort of countercultural, sort of hippie, anti-authoritarian New Age thing, they all, without an exception, say Mad Magazine was a hugely formative influence on them. And so it's funny that sort of these senatorial hearings, in some sense, that cracked down or were trying to crack down on that kind of sentiment, the law of unintended consequences sort of made it larger than they ever could have imagined, I suspect.
And yet that it's not around now seems wrong.
And I think that there are iterations of it that will continue, or whatever. You never really know in these sort of days what's going to what's going to come back or what. But it felt really like when it closed, when they said it was closing, it felt like the end of an era. I mean, there's no question.
You write about this, and I find it interesting, of the place of cartoons like the New Yorker cartoons and the great success that New Yorker has seen, especially lately with the Cartoon Bank and so forth. But even going back to Charles Adams in that magazine, what role, I mean, do they play a large role in this overall history, or are they sort of the bastard stepchild?
The New Yorker, you're saying, right?
Yeah. Well, New Yorker, yeah. Saturday Evening Post, even the Playboy cartoon, sure.
Yeah. I think, you know, it's a great question. I mean, I think, and it gets to sort of where, how we think about American comics, right? So very frequently, many of us think about it as what we would call sequential art, right? That is one panel after another panel after another panel that come and tell a story, right? But that's not the only kind of comics there is. There's also very frequently the sort of one panel comic as well, usually an image with a funny caption kind of underneath. And that was the kind of thing that the New Yorker, the Playboy, the Saturday Evening Post, they were the top addresses for. Hugh Hefner, of course, the Playboy editor-in-chief, right, started out life wanting to be a cartoonist. And everybody, you know, who worked with him said, this guy really knew how to edit cartoons. He was a very sophisticated sort of cartoon editor. You couldn't get better than people at the New Yorker, the various editors, most famously maybe recently Bob Mankoff, you know, who were publishing these things that often published these great individuals like Adams, like Charles Adams, like Ross Chast, many others, who really kind of redefined that sort of very, very primal and basic one-panel comic into something really sublime.
So where are we now as we wrap up our conversation together, Jeremy? What is the current state of American comics, and does it have a bright future, a bright history going forward?
You know, I think I'm very bullish on the future of American comics. And I look, you know, in two directions that we haven't talked that much about yet in our interview. One is that the Internet has really democratized sort of the barriers of entry into comics. So if, you know, it used to be, like I was saying, you have to live near New York. You have to sort of know the people who are in the industry, get to know them. But right now, anybody out there, anybody upstate, anybody, you know, around the country, around the world, they can draw their comics and tell their stories, and they can upload them to the Internet. And, you know, millions of people can discover them, and they can become sort of the great new storyteller of comics. And I just think that's wonderful to have that sort of variety and diversity of possibilities that are out there. So that's one reason I'm very bullish. The second is that, you know, I have little kids now, and I see how enchanted they are by comics. And that, as we were sort of alluding to, they're kind of really available everywhere now. These comics for kids, right, in the last couple of decades, you might have thought, okay, well, are comics indeed for kids anymore? But you see people like Dav Pilkey with his Dogman comics. You see Raimi Telgemeier with her graphic novels. These comics and graphic novels are selling millions and millions of copies. You know, they're being taught in public schools, right? Teachers are sort of embracing them. I think that it's just we're raising a new generation of people for whom the comics medium in this kind of, you know, graphic novel form and on the Internet are just really wonderful ways of expressing themselves and reading about themselves. And I think that's just going to continue.
The book is fascinating and just lovely. It is American Comics, A History. It is published by Norton. Jeremy Dauber, I thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program, and I wish you all the luck in the world with the book.
Thank you so much. A really wonderful conversation. Great to talk with someone who's been dealing with comics since his bookstore days.
Thank you very much. Good to talk to you. Again, the name of the new book is American Comics, A History by Jeremy Dauber. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC. All right.